Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves and I continue to be on my own. Just a bit of housekeeping. I hate to go there, but we have to do it. It just keeps to pay the bills. Patreon.com/Tortoise Shack. No ads, no sponsors, relying entirely on listeners. So if you could, please help us out. It is something we love doing, but there's no money in love, and unfortunately bills need to be paid. It's patreon.com/Tortoise Shack. And also, we are live on the Easter Bank Holiday weekend in the Sugar Club. I'm excited by the... we know now we've a couple of the lineups ready, and it's going to be a really, really great evening. Don't miss it. Tickets are available now on eventbrite.ie. Just throw in Tortoise Shack. And Built Different is back. The girls are back. Benita, Joella and Deborah are back shortly with a new series of Built Different. And if you know anything about me, it's that I'm afraid of young people. But I'm looking forward to hearing where these conversations go. Keep an eye on the Tortoise Shack for that news in the next couple of days. And so that's all that out of the way. And this is the worst segue I could do possible. But this is my conversation that I recorded a few minutes ago with Lesia Vasilenko, the Ukrainian MP, who's been contributing to this podcast before the invasion of the Russian troops into Ukraine and all the way through. Lesia will reflect on some of the diplomatic missions that she has been taking part in, and she will talk about some of the difficulties and the horrendous scenes that we have witnessed, scenes in Bucha and in the towns that she knows so well, herself being a native of Kyiv. There might be a small gap because Lesia got a little bit upset, and I did think it's best that we take it out. So, just a little bit of respect for her as someone who's been really good to continue to do this podcast under very difficult circumstances. I'll leave it there. Have a listen, and make sure that if you're watching the news today and people are talking about who clapped and who didn't and what it matters, it didn't matter a damn right now in Ukraine. It doesn't matter a damn. We have to show solidarity, and we have to put more pressure on people to end this war. It's as simple as that. This war has to end. Unfortunately, Lesia is not in a conciliatory mood, as you can definitely understand. But look, I won't. You make up your mind for your own. Thanks for the support, and I'll let you listen to the interview now. I'm delighted to be rejoined on the podcast by Ukrainian MP Lesia Vasilenko. Ukraine has now entered its 43rd day of this ongoing conflict, this war since Russia invaded, and Lesia has been on this podcast since before it happened, and continues to give us what's happening on the ground and how things have developed since then. And I'm always thrilled to talk to her. So Lesia, thanks again for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you, and you're welcome. I wish I could give more time to the podcast. I think it's brilliant, but unfortunately, with everything that's developing so quickly and so intensely in Ukraine, it's impossible to allocate more time to speaking to you guys.
Not at all. Listen, I first of all, it's good to see you, and second of all, today your president addressed at the House of the Oireachtas, our House of Parliament, and he called on again. He described the events in Bucha and how it has changed things, and you know that there's been at least 167 children killed, but yet we don't know because we haven't seen what's happened in Mariupol. We know 927 educational institutions damaged and 258 hospitals, and 78 ambulances are being reported as having been shot at. These are war crimes. How have you found it as a mother, as a Ukrainian citizen, and as a parliamentarian?
Well, in all honesty, I'm shocked. Actually, the last 48 to 72 hours have been a real roller coaster. I think we've talked about this before on the podcast as well, that how are Ukrainians feeling? And literally, it's been a roller coaster all along, but the hardest ride was these last couple of days. I'll tell you why, because first of all, we had the news that Russia is going to recall their troops from Kyiv and the vicinities, and apparently they're going to regroup and concentrate them in the east. So, for example, me, I'm from Kyiv originally, and I have a lot of friends who live in the vicinities of Kyiv, and I was sort of relieved in a way for a brief moment, and it was a smile on my face when I was hearing that they are exiting from the Kyiv region in very orderly formation. But then just a couple of hours, maybe even like an hour or so, images started popping up a bit everywhere of the devastation and the destruction in all of this suburbia, the Kyiv suburbia, which is Irpin, Bucha, Brovary, Hostomel, and all the other very strange names that you've been hearing about over these days. But these images and the stories behind them, they are just numbing and sickening at the same time. And since then, it's been, you know, it was the first time in my life that for two nights in a row, I couldn't sleep. I physically couldn't sleep. I'd never understood what insomnia was about. People were telling me I didn't understand how it worked, but it was these images in front of my eyes all the time. It was literally impossible to close your eyes. Although I must admit that at the time I was doing another diplomatic intervention, I was out of the country, like thousands of kilometers away. I was still in fear for my own life. This is how much it hits you, that you understand how close it was to your city, and that you understand how barbaric and how absolutely, absolutely atrocious everything that was happening on the ground was, and how close it was to Kyiv.
I share those in a way, but obviously I can't empathize fully because this is your city, these are your suburbs, these are your people. But when you watch those images, you can't help but be impacted. Men lying face down, shot dead, and with their hands tied behind their backs. I mean, these are the most callous and cruel images imaginable. You mentioned the diplomatic the diplomatic missions you've been on. There has been a ramping up of, you know, calls for more weapons, calls for more to be done, and more and harsher sanctions. Have you been meeting with open doors and warm receptions, and feel that some of these things, even though it maybe have going too slowly, that they are happening now?
You know, I'm confident that there are two things that can save Ukraine. It's the strong military and a strong international support. And the international support is necessary for the strong military, and also for the weakening of Russia, so that the Russian military is unable to remain as strong as it was and is still today. And with the international support, this is my front. This is where I fight. This is where I'm present most of the time. So far, we have been managing with our little parliamentary diplomatic battalion. We have been managing to secure meetings at the highest level in the UK, in France. We are working towards similar meetings in other European countries, in particular in Brussels. And also another group of us has met with the political establishment in the US and Canada. And the messages that we are hearing are very positive to Ukraine in some aspects. In other aspects, it's always you're leaving the room with this feeling that actually, well, the West could do more. And they should do more, because we're talking about not just Ukraine's independence, but we're talking about securing the global framework of peace and security as it is now. And unfortunately, if Ukraine falls, we will see a lot of disturbances in the world, in the economic markets, in the food markets, in the industrial markets, and we will see a major disturbance in international peace and security. Because essentially, if the West does nothing, if the international community does nothing to stop Russian aggression now, this will just be an inspiration to other leaders, totalitarian, authoritarian leaders, terrorist leaders, to do the same as Putin has done.
I see and I hear, you know, phrases being used about sending defensive weapons. I don't know if there's a difference between a defensive and offensive weapon, and I don't know why they're when you can see the scenes of the last few days, I don't know who can with any sense of perspective say that this is what has to happen. But in terms of the soldiers, the Ukrainian army, there were talk of, you know, fighting back the Russian troops, and but now we've seen Russia, you know, regrouping and still trying to carve out that part of eastern Ukraine that we've already spoken about at length on this podcast about what their ambitions are. This makes it impossible, and I'm saying this, you can disagree with me, but this idea and the scenes that you've seen the last 48 hours, it makes it almost impossible currently to negotiate ceasefires and truces in good faith when you see what we've seen in the last 48 hours?
Well, Russia is incapable of negotiating in good faith. I mean, Putin's whole life has been about lies and propaganda and more lies, and he doesn't care who he's going to be deceiving, whether it's going to be other global leaders or whether it's going to be his own population. I mean, he is a psychopath, and he just believes in a Russian empire. That's it. He doesn't want to hear anything else. He doesn't want to understand anything else. He's just going in all in for this dream and this goal that he has in front of his eyes. But that dream involves killing millions of people. That dream involves destroying countries, destroying families, destroying homes. Not just in Ukraine, but also in Russia. And he knows this. And he says it's okay. He's okay with Russian suffering. He's even more than okay with Ukrainian suffering. How can you negotiate when you have a counterpart, an interlocutor like that?
It was all shocking to see some of these pictures, these images. We've seen horrible tragedies and reminding me of, like, the barbarity of Sabra and Shatila and these things. And when you see these things in the streets again, it is very, very troubling. You mentioned, though, one thing that has been put to me by a Russian economist is that Putin has given a victory to the military industrial complex at the cost of his own, whereby now you've seen the UK and France and the US are ramping up and their defense budgets. And we see Germany doing this. You know, I know this is no comfort to you, but in the geopolitical landscape, he seems to have already lost this battle in terms of the military industrial complex, and that will have an impact on Russia's ability to make its army stronger into the future.
I would actually be very wary of taking the conversation down that road that Putin has already lost. Putin will lose once all of his army is disbanded, once there's no more economy left in Russia, and once there's a government change and the constitutional change in Russia. That is when we say that Putin has lost. And even afterwards, we would need to have some kind of trial period so that to make sure they don't regroup and restart what they have been doing. Putin's fate must be the same as that of Hitler and all of Hitler's regime. And that's the only way that we can get out of it. I mean, we have the story and the example of World War One and then World War Two and all the politics that went on around it. Essentially, this is a repeat of events that Europe is witnessing, except for instead of Germany, we have Russia now. We have Russia to deal with. I think that it's great that military budgets are being amplified across Europe and across the globe. This is a necessity at the moment to counter Russia's aggression. I'm sorry, there is no peaceful way out of it, and there's no diplomatic way out of it, just because we're dealing with a completely mad and crazy terrorist leader. But at the same time, we have to be firm in our actions. And I think it's only once there's collective defense and security action coming from all the international community members that we can start and that we can only start to really.
You couldn't be any clearer. You effectively want regime change there. But one thing I will say that is striking is Germany's and the EU has been. You know, we're talking, and again, we were supposed to talk about. You know, yesterday the IPCC report came out. I don't know if you got a moment to even think about it, but you know, there's talk of we've 3 years left in terms of the climate crisis, about the 1.5%, and yet the EU is unwilling to get to siphon itself off the fossil fuels that we are effectively using. And let's be honest about this, folks, when we're listening to this, the money that we pay feeds the military industrial complex of Russia. So the EU hands over, I think it's $1 billion a day for Russian gas and oil. And now we're saying, well, we won't use coal anymore. And I know Germany have been very reticent to go down the road of reducing the gas and oil as well. And it is all interlinked, Lesia. Do you feel that we should be doing more and sending better signals when it comes to this, particularly around the fossil fuel issue and the EU?
Yeah, well, the fossil fuel issue is like a whole different issue. I mean, like, this is the greatest example of hypocrisy that we have as of late. I mean, on the one hand, you have EU leaders speaking about decarbonization, the EU Green Deal, zero emissions by 2050, and so on. But this is just declarative talk, and this is just lip service, essentially, if Europe continues to fight for the right to buy Russian petrol, Russian gas, and all the other fossil fuels. So at this point, I think that for the people of Europe, for the people living in all the different countries, they should really think twice about what their political leaders are telling them. On the one hand, they are sort of declaring we're going to fight climate change, it's our common problem, and so on, and we owe it to the future generations to leave them a world where they can actually live in a clean air, clean water, and so on and so forth. But on the other hand, they are not exactly going to do anything about it, are they? Because they are seriously considering continuing buying Russian oil and Russian gas. And buying gas and oil, in principle, doesn't matter from where, does nothing to combating climate change. Like, literally nothing. It makes things worse. So it just shows that all of that talk is just empty words, and that nobody was really serious about it, were they?
No, I just find there is a hypocrisy at the heart of that. And to make matters worse, I've heard people saying, oh, we'll go down the LNG road, as if because you call it LNG, it's all of a sudden clean. It's not. It's you're fracking. It's worse. We're peeling the layers of the earth. Leslie, I just, in terms of the days ahead, I know, again, I saw your colleague, Maria Messenseva, who was part of one of the diplomatic missions, was talking to people in the UK about weapons. This now is, there was all sorts of hope around some sort of, end game on this. There doesn't feel like there's going to be, and listening to your president, he seems to be committed to this, well, not committed to this war, but resigned to fighting this war for a number of years now. Does it feel like there's no end in sight now?
Look, there's the end, and the end will be victory of Ukraine. We will stand as long as we have to, and we've been speaking on every single show that we've done with you. We've been speaking about this. Ukrainians have been determined from day one, and our determination is only growing stronger. We will stand united until the very last soldier leaves Ukrainian soil.
I think that's look. Yeah, you're right. You've been saying this all the way through. Can I just the last thing in terms of the people who are displaced? It's now, you know, we've now seen in Ireland alone 14,000 people have arrived. We're not a big country, you know. There's talk that we'll be taking up to 100,000, which again we should take as many as are required. The idea that there has been that form of solidarity and that form of, you know, opening up, has that been welcomed by the people in Ukraine, that there's at least the EU has opened its borders and there does seem to be a warm house for treating people, especially in light of, like I heard today, Ireland being mentioned as one of the countries that was pushing to fast track EU membership, whatever your thoughts on that are, but that's one of the things we were singled out for on a named with a couple of other countries. Has that sent a good message, at least that there's some form of solidarity among citizens?
Absolutely. Like, first of all, Ireland has been one of the most generous countries to Ukrainians. And just the welcome that Ukrainians receive from the people is huge. It's been very easy to get to. The support is there. The support mechanisms are very clear and easy to use. I have had no complaints from Ukrainians who have traveled to Ireland to seek temporary refuge. At the same time, today's news that Ireland welcomes Ukraine's EU membership, that's extremely useful for us as well, and I hope that we can build on that and we can build on the EU member states that are willing to allow the fast track of the procedure of EU accession. So again, here I can just say that we're extremely grateful.
Alessia Vasilenko, I won't delay you. I know you have a lot on, and I hope you can go and have a little bit of me time as well. So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. Stay safe and we'll keep in touch. Talk to you very soon.
Thank you.
That was Ukrainian MP Alessia Vasilenko, and I'm sure you can get from her how angry she is, how hurt she is, how devastated she is, and yet how steadfast her belief is that Ukraine will ultimately win this awful, awful conflict. We'll leave it there. We will be back tomorrow. We have more coming, but you know what? I'll just leave it there for today. Thanks for listening, folks. Thanks for sharing, letting people know. And more importantly, thanks for supporting us. Talk to you all very soon. Take care. Bye bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.